This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Truth Marked, Book 2 of the Fate Marked Epic, written by David Estes, performed by Derek Perkins. The story so far. The Hundred Years' War has stretched over a century, ravaging the nations of the Four Kingdoms. Before the war began, a prophecy was made by a woman now known as the Western Oracle. The prophecy, which promised the coming of the Fate Marked, who would bring peace to the lands, has been forgotten by many, while others believe it to be naught but a legend. Still, the truth of the ancient words has begun to come to pass, as there are those being born with strange markings that grant the bearers unusual powers. In some lands, the marked are revered, in others, hated, even put to death. One of the Fate Marked, the King's Bane, has his own prophecy, to bring death to 8 rulers across the 4 kingdoms, which will usher in a time of peace. His work has already begun. 3 rulers have been killed in swift succession. King Wulfric Geric, known as the Dread King of the North, King Gil Loren of the West, and King Oran Ironclad, the Juggernaut of the East, have all fallen. But Bane's task is far from finished, and now he plans to turn his attention to the south. Little is known of what has been transpiring in the southern empires of Calip and Fanes, except that the 2 nations have been embroiled in a civil war caused by the marriage dissolution of the 2 main sovereigns, Empress Sun Sands and Emperor Vin Hosa. In the kingdoms, however, time has marched ever onwards. To the west, with the death of King Gil Loren at the hand of the King's Bane, his eldest nephew, Jove Loren, attempts to usurp the throne from the true heir, Princess Rhea Loren. To accomplish this, Rhea is charged by the Furia with breaking her vow of purity with a common thief known as Grease Jolly, an alias for his true name, Grey Aris. As punishment, a W for whore is carved on her face, leaving permanent scars. In her mind, her greatest attribute, her beauty, has been stripped from her, leaving her with nothing left but revenge. When her horror and sadness turn to white-hot anger, she murders her cousin Jove and reclaims her crown, vowing next to win the war and defeat her enemies on all sides. Meanwhile, Grey Aris's sister, Shae Aris, who is fate-marked, is abducted by the Furia and taken south to a chain of islands called the Dead Isles, which are rumoured to be haunted. Grey, charged with thievery, has his hand cut off as punishment, but manages to escape Night's End with some help from Rhea. Grey follows the Furia, eventually hiring onto a ship the Jewel, which is headed south. His goal? Find his sister and rescue her. To the north. After Bane murders the Dread King, the crown shifts to Archer Geric. However, before he can claim it, his uncle, Lord Griswold, swoops in, accusing he and his mother, Sabria Loren, of conspiring to kill the king. The eldest of the king's heirs, Anis, feels powerless as she watches the execution of her mother. When Archer is brought to be executed, however, the executioner suddenly makes himself known as a famous warrior known as the Armored Knight. They escape through the sewers along with another knight, Sir Dietrich. While they travel to the southern part of the realm, Anis realizes she has turned 18 and now has the primary claim on the throne. She refuses to tell her brother, though she confides in the Armored Knight, who turns out to be her long-lost friend from childhood, Terin Shiri, believed to be dead, but now cursed by the witch's potion that saved his life. They also meet up with their eccentric aunt, Lady Zelda, who reveals that the King's Bane is actually their younger brother, who was smuggled from the north immediately after birth. When the Easterners attack Raiders Pass, Archer is knocked unconscious by the King's Bane, his own brother, who turns up to try to kill Anis, who is now the lawful Queen of the North. However, Sir Dietrich manages to fight Bane off, showcasing his uncanny skills with the blade. Bane, exhausted from the ordeal, vanishes. Anis and the others seize victory from the east, killing King Ironclad and others. Now, with Anis having declared herself the true queen, and with Archer comatose, the Gerics and their allies are marching north toward Castle Hill to to reclaim the throne from the usurper, Lord Griswold. To the east. When a young man named Roan, who grew up in Calypso, contracts the plague from a mysterious beggar on the street, he's sent to quarantine on an island called Dragon's Breath. There he reveals his own fate mark, called the Life Mark, which allows him to heal himself and escape the island, which is guarded by two-headed dragons. Fateful currents pull him to the east, where a chance meeting makes him the prisoner of Prince Gareth Ironclad, who immediately brings him to Ironwood and the eastern capital of Feria, the Iron City, where humans live in harmony with the Aurians, a mystical people who can channel the ore that lies beneath the forest. With the help of one of the Aurians, a fate-marked named Gwendolyn Storm, King Ironclad swiftly learns of Roan's marking and forces him into helping their armies as they march on Raiders Pass to enact revenge on the North for the killing of the Queen. Roan reluctantly agrees, and soon learns that the East has another of the fate-marked, a mighty warrior named Bjorn Stonesledge, the Iron-marked. Roan also discovers that, as the firstborn son, Gareth is the Shield, which means his life is forfeit, to be given to protect the second-born son, Guy, the true heir to the Eastern throne. Along the way, Roan begins to grow close to both Gwen and Gareth. At Raiders Pass, the North defeats them, killing King Ironclad, Prince Guy Ironclad, and injuring Bjorn Stonesledge. Gareth Ironclad is nearly killed by the King's Bane as he tries to protect Guy, but Roan saves him by using his life mark. In the aftermath of defeat, Gwendolyn Storm realizes who Roan really is. Roan Loren, Prince of the West, and true heir to the Western Kingdom. She helps him escape, and together they slip away, crossing the border between nations and into the Tangle, the largest western forest, known to be almost impassable. And now, the story continues. Part 1. Bane, the Beggar, Jai, Rhea, Anise, Raven, Roan, Grey. The warmongers shall resist the flow of destiny, until they are shattered upon sword and shield, sorcery and magic. Truth, in the end, shall reign. The Western Oracle. 1. The Northern Kingdom, Silent Mountain. Bane Gerrick. He was leaving the only home he'd ever known, the little cave high on the western flank of Silent Mountain. Bear Blackboots was long gone, and soon Bane would be, too. He didn't blame the man he'd always known as Father for leaving. There was so much blood on both their hands that sometimes Bane felt as if he was drowning in it, a lake of crimson forcing its way down his throat. He saw the lake in his dreams, too, only it was burning, the waters literally on fire. How it was possible for liquid to burn, he didn't know. When he dreamed about the lake of fire, he could never divert his eyes from the flames, which licked at the bloody lake, an inferno of death and pain and their cries. He could hear them, too, his victims screaming. "Are they innocent?" he wondered to himself. "Does it matter?" And in his dream, he would always be drawn to the lake, to the fire, to the cries. He would stumble down the rocky embankment, pulled forward by an irresistible force. He would pause on the precipice of the shimmering waters for a long, naked moment, the heat of the flames washing over him like a summer wind, and then he would fall. He always awoke before he hit the water, before the fire could touch him, burn him, before those he'd murdered could judge him for his sins. Why, he did not know, but he always felt invigorated afterwards, ready for what was to come next. All he knew was that three rulers were dead. His uncle, King Gil Loren of the Western Kingdom, King Oren Ironclad, the Juggernaut of the East, and King Wulfric Gerrick of the Northern Kingdom, his father. "What kind of a person kills their own father?" he wondered. He shook his head and cast away the pointless question. What he was didn't matter. All that mattered was the Western Oracle's prophecy, the one he was meant to fulfill. his only purpose. 8 rulers shall die in the name of peace. 8 bloody rulers, sent to the lake of fire. 3 were dead. 5 would follow. Lost in his thoughts, his hand absently touched the flesh of his unnaturally bald scalp, a place where hair had never grown. He could feel the heat of his fate mark pulsating, hotter in the 3 sections that had already been filled in with blood. He bit his lip and then dropped his hand. He shouldered his pack, which he'd stuffed with provisions, melted snow, smoked meat, extra clothing, a knife, though he wasn't certain he needed such earthly things any more. Bane was going south, and death would quench his thirst and feed him and clothe him. The knife, yes, he would need the knife. Something drew him, a dark energy like his own, which was closing in on one of his prey. No, not something. Someone. I don't have to be alone anymore, he thought, and then vanished. 2. The Southern Empire, Calip. The Beggar. He was the plague. The plague was him. Even now, as he stood watching the Empress's cavalcade, he could feel the disease flowing through his blood, humming along his skin, billowing from his mouth with each exhalation. He had killed before. Oh, mother! Many times. Oh, father! Countless souls devoured by what was in him, the evil that trembled along his pale flesh. The procession thundered past, a long line of horses and the guanic, the reptilian creatures with clawed feet and mouths full of fangs, their pink tongues hissing between their black lips. Their riders, the royal guard, or guanero, wore dark leather armour bearing the dragon-rising sigil of the kingdom of Calip. In the midst of their protectors rode Empress Sun Sands and her trio of daughters, in order of birth, raven, fire, and whisper. The guanic they rode were the largest of the group, towering above the others, giving the crowd a clear view of their leaders. And their leaders a clear view of the crowd. Empress Sun was like a ray of light, her hair long and blonde, an impressive contrast to her night-dark skin. The juxtaposition was such that her figure appeared to be cut from alternating daggers of sunshine and shadow. I am ready, the beggar thought. He melted into the crowd, almost vaporous in his movements, like a curling billow of smoke. The Southrons called him many things out of fear, Death's Bastard, Demon Child, and other worse titles. But the name he liked the best was the Beggar. That wasn't always your name. He pushed away the thought because it was an echo from the past, no longer relevant to today. No, that boy was long gone, fading like mist at first light. I am the Beggar. For that's what he was. He wasn't a beggar in the classic sense. He had no interest in food or water, but a beggar of forgiveness. Because of his tattooia, the mark on his neck, 3 partial circles, joined in the middle, broken at the edges, most could not really see him. Well, they could see him, but not the real him. To any he happened to meet, they would have little memory of him later, and could only describe him as a smudge of shadow wearing a grey hood. There was one exception to this rule, those who also bore a tattooia. He knew this because once he'd been spotted by one of the Empress's daughters, Fire Sands, the girl who bore the fire mark. Her eyes had zoned in on him like a hawk hunting a field mouse, but he'd managed to slip away into the crowd before she could determine whether he'd been real or just a trick of the hot southern sun. There had been one other, a young man who'd been knocked over by a royal procession, not unlike the one he was watching now, who the beggar had helped to his feet. A young man who he'd killed by accident, touching him with his plague-infected skin through a tear in his glove. A man who surely must have been marked, because he could see him clearly. Roan, the man had called himself. That man was likely sent to Plague Island, like the rest of the beggar's victims. Sent to die. Quarantined from the rest of Calip. There were whisperings that the island had been destroyed by dragons. but those were only rumours, of course. The beggar wondered what power Roan's Tatuya had given him. He also wondered if the poor man had died slowly and painfully, or if he'd found a way to end things quicker. He was snapped out of his morbid reverie when, suddenly, one of the riders cried out. Horses were commanded to halt, and the Guanic, as if by some instinct, skidded to a stop.
"I am ready."
The beggar stepped forward, separating himself from the crowd, which was backing away from the fearsome lizards, which snapped their jaws and clawed in the dirt. Amidst her protectors, a young woman slid lithely from her Guanic's scaly shoulders. Her hair was so dark it was almost blue, plaited down her back where it dangled, snake-like, to her waist. The beggar knew her on sight. She was Raven Sands, eldest daughter of the Empress and first daughter to the Calypsian Empire. An 8-barbed whip dangled from one hand, and she wore a black, sleeveless leather tunic that would have made even the most liberal of Westerners gasp on sight, as well as a short skirt that left little to the imagination. Her exposed skin was brown, not quite as dark as her mother's, smooth, and seemed to go on forever.
"Was she the one who had called out?"
the beggar wondered.
"Sister, why did you stop us?"
Raven asked, looking over her shoulder.
"I could ask the same thing, Fire,"
the Empress said, though she remained mounted. Fire Sands, the second daughter, leapt from her scaly steed, flanking her eldest sister. Fire, like both her sisters, was named in the usual Calypsian manner, her physical attributes linked to the natural world. In the princess's case, her Tatuya was a fire mark, it was said, thus her namesake. Her skin was a shade darker than Raven's. Her short hair was like a candle flame atop her scalp, lighting a serious expression. She was scanning the crowd intently, looking for something.
"No," the beggar realized. "Not something. Someone. Me. She's looking for me. That's why she stopped the procession. She caught a glimpse of me."
And, unlike the last time she'd spotted him, he held his ground, even going so far as to take a step forward, then another.
"What am I doing?"
he wondered to himself. It hit him like a sandstone block to the head.
"I want to be caught. I want to be captured. I want to be killed. I am ready."
He was all alone now, a grey island in an ocean of dust. The third daughter swept beside her siblings.
"Can we go, please?"
Whisper Sand said, her voice like wind moving over a desert dune. 4 years Raven's junior, Whisper was small and thin, and wore a white flowing dress that nearly reached the ground, rivaling the length of her chestnut hair, which was so long it could be braided and used as rope. Of the three sisters, her skin was the lightest.
"Wait,"
Fire said, drawing her sword. Flames leapt from her fingers onto the weapon. A sigh of awe rose up from the crowd. The beggar watched with interest. He'd never seen someone with a Tatuya use their power. Well, except for himself, and he had little control over the plague, which seemed as wild as a chestful of snakes. The way she flaunted her power captivated him.
"Wait for what?"
Whisper asked.
"She can't see me," the beggar thought. "Not really. None of them can, save for Fire." "Princesses,"
a man said, striding in front of the sisters. He was garbed from head to toe in leather armour marked with the royal sigil, a silver dragon over a rising red sun. The Shiva, the master of order in Calypso. His dark eyes roamed the crowd, passing over the beggar like he didn't even exist.
"We cannot tarry here. It's not safe."
"I am only following the Empress's orders," Fire said, scanning the crowd once more. The beggar didn't wait for her gaze to settle on him. He stepped forward again. Closer. Closer. He wanted to say something, tried to say something, but his words were swallowed by a sudden wave of emotion that crashed through him. Relief. From there, everything happened quickly. Fire leapt forward, her sword blazing. She kicked him in the stomach, knocking him over. The beggar closed his eyes, waiting for the flames to consume him. He felt nothing. Something was cast over him, thick and warm.
He opened his eyes to darkness.
A blanket, he realized.
Voices were there, too, but they were like the sound of individual drops of rain in a thunderstorm, impossible to isolate. Anyway, he didn't care what they had to say about him, not any more. Soon he'd be killed, and then he'd be free.
3. The Southern Empire. Fanes. Jai Jaru.
None knew of his mark, and it was better that way. Though those bearing a tattooia were generally revered, almost worshipped, in the southeastern land of Fanes, Jai Jaru knew such adoration wouldn't apply to him. No, not when his mark went against everything the current Emperor Vin Hosa, the slave master, believed in. Standing in front of Emperor Hosa now, Jai was acutely aware of the mark on his heel. Though it was hidden, he could see it in his mind's eye, the scales of justice gleaming like a lit candle.
"Master Jaru," the Emperor said, "what do you have to report?"
The Emperor stroked his dark moustache and goatee, which reminded Jai of an arrowhead. Hosa's face was powdered with the finest sifted chalk dust, a stark contrast to his black hair. His dark, tight braids were piled atop his head in a honeycomb formation. Tied within his hair and beard were diamonds, sparkling in the natural light streaming through an ornate, beveled windowpane. Gaudy jewelry, rings, adorned all 10 fingers, studded with emeralds, rubies, and diamonds. The wealth on this man's fingers and hair alone could feed all the slaves in Fenia. As if that wasn't enough, the Emperor had jewels sewn into his skin in the typical Phoenician manner. His chest, his arms, even his forehead glittered with 2 lines of jewels, replacing his eyebrows, which had been permanently removed. Vinhosa sat comfortably in a plush chair, leaning back slightly. Behind him were the great pillars of Fenia, 3 black marble columns so wide around it would take 12 men to surround even one of them. On each was engraved a symbol, representing the 3 great pillars of Fanes, the fist, the sword, the whip. The fist was for brothers, used both to settle disputes and to slap one another on the back when the brawl was over. The sword was for enemies, to cut throats and stab hearts. The whip was for slaves, its lash a constant reminder. The Emperor governed his kingdom by these 3 tenets and no others. Emperor Hosa's eyes generally appeared to be pulled too tight, as if they were incapable of blinking, and yet they did. His mouth was almost always open a sliver, the tip of his pink tongue protruding. Most of his muscular chest was bare, save for a panel of leather secured by 2 straps. The panel was painted with the Phoenician sigil, the 4-eyed lioness. A sleepy spotted python lay curled around Hosa's chair, its long sinuous body so thick that no man would be able to wrap his hands around it. Yet even a python this large was relatively small for the species, which had been known to grow as large as the dragons that patrolled Kalip. Living underground in the desert, there were rumors that some red pythons could grow as long as the tallest trees in the tangle. In its sleep, the enormous snake's thin, forked tongue hissed from its mouth intermittently. Several guards stood beside the Emperor at attention, but even they were too far away to be of much use. "I could draw the knife from my belt and plunge it through his heart before—" Jai blinked away the thought, for he knew the Emperor could enslave him with naught but a touch. After all, Vin Hosa bore a tattooia, too. The slave mark. And unlike Jai, he didn't hide his mark. Torches burned all around his chair, illuminating the symbol on his neck and upper chest. 4 lengths of iron chain, linked in the center. Instead of killing the Emperor, Jai said, "Garadia mine is producing at full capacity. Diamonds flow from the chutes like a river." "Of course they do," Jai thought. "Anything less would mean the slaves get whipped, and I cannot allow that."
"Good. Increase production by 10%, the Emperor said, waving his hand casually, as if to say, "Now be gone."
Jai didn't move, his jaw set.
"That's impossible," he said through gritted teeth. He
could feel a film of sweat begin to form beneath his own layer of face powder.
He knew it was a mistake to question a direct command from Hoser, but he couldn't help himself. Not when the slaves under his command were already so broken. Not when his justice mark flared at the thought of the injustice of their very existence. Jai stood, waiting to be punished for his insolence. To his surprise, however, the slave master only laughed, his tongue flicking out like the spotted pison's.
"Master Giroux, all my life's experience has taught me one thing. Nothing is impossible. Once I would have thought it impossible that my wife, the light of my life, could ever leave me, and yet she did, all for a bunch of dogs."
The Calypsian Empress, Sun Sands, Jai thought. When their marriage union was shattered, civil war exploded in the south. A war that had lasted for a dozen years already. Evidently, Empress Sun was against the use of slaves.
Dogs, as Vinhosa liked to refer to them as.
The Emperor continued,
"I have great power, and I won't waste it. Not when there is land to be conquered, people to be enslaved, wealth to be obtained. Did you know that there is an attempt on my life every day? Sometimes more than one. And it's not because the people hate me, no, nothing like that. It's because there's a superstition that my power will go to the man," he paused thoughtfully, "or woman, who kills me. You see? Everyone wants what I have. But I won't die easily. And as long as I am emperor, as long as I bear this mark," he gestured to his chest, "I will demand the impossible. And I will get it. Especially now when my enemies are destroying so much of what I've built. The black tears are worse than the Calypsian plague."
Jai had trouble controlling his expression. Over the last few years, the rebel group known as the Black Tears had been gaining in strength and boldness. Twice they'd released slaves from their mines. The first group were caught and killed, and now the mine continued to lie vacant, not producing. The second group, however, had disappeared somewhere along the southernmost tip of the spear. Jai hoped they'd managed to cross the fast-moving river and escape into Calip, but the Emperor was certain they had drowned.
Lost resources, he called them.
Not much was known of the secretive rebels, except that they were thought to be supporters of Sun Sands before her feud with her husband, and that they etched permanent markings of black tears on their cheeks, each of which was supposedly meant to represent someone they had killed. A death tally, so to speak. Also, according to rumour, every member of the Black Tears was a woman.
"The Black Tears,"
Hoser said again, practically spitting the name out in disgust.
"May they rot in the void."
The Emperor paused again, licking his lips and studying his rings. His gaze travelled sharply back to Jai, and he changed the subject.
"I have heard whispers of your methods as a mine master. They are decidedly unorthodox."
"And yet I get results," Jai said. He'd had trouble with several of his underlings who didn't agree with his methods. Almost certainly it was one of them who had whispered in the Emperor's ear.
"Some say the slaves are the masters of the mine, rather than you and your comrades."
Jai didn't like the way this conversation was going, but he remained silent, letting the Emperor choose the course.
"What would you say to your critics?"
Hoser finally asked, when it was clear Jai would not speak. Jai clenched his fists at his sides. "That results are results, and the means aren't important. My mine is the highest producing in the Empire. Now I know that it's not my slaves who are spreading my secrets, so it must be one of my mine masters. That is unacceptable behaviour that must be punished." The Emperor stared at him with eyes as dark as unlit coals. For a moment, Jai feared he'd been too brazen with his words, that his people would suffer as a result. But then the Emperor laughed again and said,
"Indeed, insolence must be met with strength. Bring him in."
On command, two bare-chested guards dragged in a man. At first, Jai didn't recognize him, such was his transformation in appearance. Wearing nothing but a ripped beige sackcloth, the man was a mess of bruises and cuts. His previously long hair had been shorn to the scalp. His eyes wore a vacant, wild expression. His face was without powder for the first time in Jai's recollection, the skin beneath brown with a hint of orange. But the man was Phoenician, not Terran, like most of the slaves.
Master Axa, Jai thought.
He was one of his most outspoken and violent mine masters. On multiple occasions, Jai had to punish this man for beating one of his workers within an inch of their lives. Jai wasn't surprised it was this snake of a man who'd betrayed him. "What shall I do with him?" Hoser asked Jai now.
"Please,"
Axa said, dropping to his knees and knitting his hands together. His narrow eyes locked with Jai's, full of fear and something else, a request for mercy, for forgiveness. In his current state, Axa seemed penitent, and yet he had plenty of his own small jewels sewn into his skin, a reminder of what he once was, what he still represented. Violence, oppression, arrogance, wealth. And yet something about his plea for mercy rang false. Jai's justice mark told him as much. But why would the man lie? Axa really was at Jai's mercy. He considered his options. The Emperor respected swift and harsh punishment, but something told him killing the master would be a mistake. Also, it wasn't the way Jai did things. As usual, when faced with a decision such as this one, his justice mark flared on his heel and provided the answer, as clear as a spoken word in his mind. "Give him to me," he said. "His mind, his body, his soul."
"No,"
Axa breathed. Again, the word itself was false, but Jai didn't have time to consider what that might mean. The Emperor smiled. Jai had chosen wisely.
"As you wish."
The Emperor touched Axa's scalp, and the tattoo on Hoser's chest flared to life, shimmering with red and gold and orange light. Axa screamed and began to shake as a similar marking appeared on his own chest, the chains wrapping around his neck, tightening, releasing, and then settling in. The whites of his eyes turned to darkness, like a sky upon the onset of night. He stopped screaming, stopped shaking, stood stiffly.
"What is your command, master?"
he said to the Emperor. Hoser's lips curled up on one side.
"I give you to Master Jeru, from this day forward until I command otherwise. You will obey his every command. Is this clear?"
"Yes, master."
Though it was what Jai had requested, watching the creation of another slave by the slave master himself twisted his stomach into knots. He hated the dark, glazed look in Axa's eyes, the flat, obedient sound of his voice, the stiffness in his movements. Once more, Hoser flicked his fingers, and this time Jai spun on his heels and departed. Axa trailed behind like a well-trained dog. One of the Emperor's sons was waiting outside, Falcon, the oldest and meanest of the Hoser brood. His scalp was shaved to the skin, save for a long stripe of hair down the center, pressed together to look like a blade. On either side of the mohawk were emeralds sewn into his powdered skin to look like eyes. Diamond earrings that likely came from Garadia mine studded each earlobe. Falcon was known to be a master of Fen Ru, the art of attack, the most popular martial art amongst the Phoenician elite, including most mine masters and soldiers. Like all the masters, Jai had also been trained in Fen Ru, but it wasn't the style of fighting he preferred. No, his father had taught him Fen Lu, the art of defense, as a child. Now he was a master of both, something no one knew about him.
"Master Jeru,"
Falcon grunted.
"Falcon," Jai said.
The two brushed past each other without a second glance. It was no secret that Falcon wanted command of Garadia for himself. It was the most valuable mine in the Empire, after all. Jai shuddered to think what would happen to the slaves under the future Emperor's control. Then again, with Vin Hoser's decree to increase diamond output by 10%, it didn't much matter who was the master of Garadia. Worked to the bone, most of the slaves would die anyway. "Unless I do something about it," Jai thought. He shook his head, ignoring the dark stares of the other two white-faced Hoser brothers, Fang and Fox, as he passed. There was nothing he could do. There were 5,000 slaves in Garadia, far too many to escape with. And even if he did, they'd be hunted down and killed for desertion one by one, along with him. He wouldn't let them suffer more. He couldn't. Maybe there's another way, he thought. An idea appeared and then vanished, evading him. It had to do with a story his father once told him. A story about the Southron gates. He squinted as he left the palace and emerged into the oven that was the city of Fania. He'd once heard someone say that the sun was different in the south, fierier, that the brazen sun rose earlier in the south than anywhere else in the Four Kingdoms, assaulting the horizon like an invading army of fire-bearing warriors. To Jai, however, the sun was just the sun, an oppressive, sweltering yellow orb. And there was nowhere hotter than Fania, which was formed of stone canyons cut in perfect corridors beneath the surface of the desert, creating underground blocks. Although the canyons were straight and narrow, connecting into large squares, it was said the city was built by the gods, not men or nature, cut into the earth long before the Phoenicians arrived in these lands. If so, thought Jai, the gods are trying to cook us alive. Although the tall cliffs provided plenty of shade, the stone canyons tended to trap the heat rather than deflect it, creating a superheated box where everything seemed to move slower. He cuffed a hand over his brow to block the sun, and made his way to his chariot, which awaited his return. Along the way, he passed dozens of statues lining the pathway, which was constructed of crushed crystal, scattered underfoot like gravel. The Phoenicians loved their statues, which were carved in the images of their past emperors, including Vin Hoser's father, Jin. On the walls of the canyons were even larger statues, cut into the face of the stone wall itself, massive busts of the Hoser dynasty. Jai ignored their stares, which seemed to burn right through him. When he reached the chariot, a slave driver stood ready, expecting orders. Jai climbed aboard. "To Garadia," he said, and the driver cracked his whip. He glanced back at Axa, who was trying not to choke on the dust left in the chariot's wake. "You will walk back to Garadia mine," he commanded. The new slave began to walk. Palace slaves toiling in the heat looked up as he passed, but, fearing the lash of their masters, just as quickly lowered their heads. Each were branded with the same chain marking Axa now wore. Most of them were full Terrans, having been taken from the southern nation of Terragon, which was located across the burning sea. The Terran slaves' skin was red, and their black eyes were round. Once they likely had bright blue eyes, but not any more. Probably never again. The women had long, coppery hair, while the men's hair was shorn to the scalp. Traditionally, it was the opposite. Terran men wore their hair long, usually braided, while the women preferred shorter hair. However, as soon as the Terrans were enslaved, the Phoenician slave masters forced them to adapt to their own customs. Mixed amongst them was the occasional dreadnoughter, the strange folk from the Calypsian Islands, with their broad, flat foreheads and grizzled grey skin. There weren't as many of them, however, as ever since the Southron Civil War had begun 12 years earlier, Vin Hoser no longer had naval access to the dreadnoughts due to the blockade enacted by Empress Sun Sands. Jai tried not to think about the slaves, though his heel was on fire. Ever since he'd been a young boy, Jai Giroo had known the meaning of truth and justice. It was bred into him, into the mark on his heel, into his head, his heart. He could tell when someone was lying. He could sense when a great inequality was being dealt. In Fania, in the presence of the slaves, he sensed it all the time. Void. He'd felt it in his own household, which had several slaves, including her. The thought made him grit his teeth and clutch the side of the chariot harder. After his father was killed, Jai had come up with an insane plan. He'd trained to be a master of slaves, working his way from field lord to house lord to mine master. And then, because of his success, he'd been promoted to master of Garadia.
Miraculously, his plan had worked. He was finally in a position to do something, to help someone, and yet he felt more helpless than ever. They emerged into the inner city, where the wealthy took up residence in large caverns cut into the rock face. Some of the most lavish living quarters even had water that cascaded down the walls, cooling the caves. In the shade of the narrow canyon, men and women strutted like peacocks on the streets, regaling themselves with mindless chatter, used as an excuse to display their finest silk clothes and blood jewellery, much of which was sewn into their faces and skin. Both the males and females had powdered faces, a Phoenician tradition that had begun when the first Terran slaves were brought across the Burning Sea. It was an attempt by the people of Fanes to differentiate themselves even further from the slaves, though Jai found it rather ridiculous. Most Phoenician skin was naturally brown, while the Terran's skin carried a reddish hue. Their eyes were different, too, the slaves, wide and round, versus the thin, narrow eyes of their masters. In the canyons of Fania, the people ate delicacies sold by middle-class vendors with permanent stone platforms that lined the road. Grasshoppers and caterpillars were roasted in oil squeezed from grum nuts, a sweet nut that grew on lush, brown trees that thrived in the shade of the canyons. Smoke rose from a stone pit where a long green pison roasted on a spit, a bald Terran slave boy turning it slowly by hand to ensure the rubbery meat cooked evenly. A group of women practiced the art of Fen Sir, the final of the three martial arts, which was named after the sun goddess herself. Fen Sir was considered a feminine art, more like a dance than a way of fighting, and was used mostly in ceremonies and celebrations. The women moved together, aiming high kicks at the sky and lithely springing off their hands. Jai looked away, because watching the dance of the sun god always reminded him of his mother. And then the chariot moved beyond into the outer city, slave quarters flashing by on either side. The slaves, who were primarily red-skinned Terrans, lived in tiny cubicles cut into the stone walls, stacked on top of each other like hollow blocks, stretching nearly all the way to the surface. From afar, the slave residences resembled long grey honeycombs rolled out along the canyon walls. Those who lived above ground had to climb narrow, crumbling stone steps to reach their beds. Sometimes one of them would slip and fall to their death, though their Phoenician masters seemed to care little and less about these unfortunate tragedies. Slaves were easily replaceable, and it would be costly to repair the steps. Jai trained his gaze firmly ahead, afraid of what he might do if he saw more suffering, more hardship. No, he needed to be smart when he finally chose to act. Or maybe he was just making excuses. He wasn't certain anymore. The canyons of the gods ended, and Jai pulled the hood of his cloak over his head to block the harsh sunlight. Yet, despite the heat, he felt cooler outside the city. He felt like he could breathe again. Without the city, the landscape was a burnt wasteland of imposing plateaus, carved earth, and red buttresses rising against the cloudless sky. Axa would be lucky to survive the journey on foot, or unlucky, depending on the perspective. Far into the distance was an enormous rock, Garadia Mine, named after the man who discovered the secrets inside it, the wealth beyond measure. The chariot followed the well-worn path across the rocky landscape, spitting up clouds of dust from its brass wheels. Lost in the monotony of the desert landscape, Jai's thoughts from earlier came back to him. The memory of a story told by his father, who had fought in several battles against the west along the Southron gates. How the wall had once crumbled on the eastern side after being hit by a barrage of projectiles and several battering rams. Evidently, in his haste, the emperor at the time, Jin Hoza, Vin's father, had patched together a repair team that left the inner core of the wall empty, a series of tunnels through the wall. By all appearances from the exterior, the wall looked as solid as a mountain, but, according to Jai's father, was a breach waiting to happen.
"But how can I use this knowledge?"
Jai wondered. Even if he could sneak a small group of slaves from the mine, they would still have to traverse the desert from Fania to the Bloody Canyons. face the rugged terrain and vultures known to nest in the canyons themselves, and then slip past one of the border towns, Susa preferably, because it was the easternmost city, closest to the rumoured weakness in the wall. Jai knew he'd be sentencing them all to death, both the people he took and the ones he left behind. Is doing nothing worse? Is a life of hardship and forced labour worse than death?
Yes, he whispered. Master,
the slave driver said, thinking he'd been issued a command.
Drive on for Garadia,
Jai muttered. Of course, the slave obeyed.
4. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Lorraine.
The red-barbed funnel is the most poisonous spider in the world. Did you know that?
Rhea asked. The red-haired woman was huddled in the corner, her head down. Her hair was tangled and matted, covering her face. She didn't respond. But Rhea didn't care. It was meant to be more of a rhetorical question, a part of her ongoing monologue. The spider crawled along her palm, repeatedly dashing its mouth against her skin, trying to sting her with the red barbs inside its mouth. The barbs containing the deadliest poison in the world. Rhea laughed, letting the spider crawl across to her other palm.
So deadly, and yet it cannot use its poison against humans. See?
The spider tried again and again, never giving up its attack. Crawling and striking, crawling and striking.
Its mouth is too small. Isn't that amusing?
Again, there was no response from the woman who used to be one of the three, the Furies that led the Furia, the righteous warriors of wrath and servants to the crown. The woman who now appeared as broken as a porcelain plate smashed on the ground.
See how it strikes again and again, desperate to end me.
She placed her palm against the side of a table, and the spider crawled onto it.
And yet I am the one who holds its life in my hands.
Her fist slammed down with a thud that made the Fury flinch in the corner. When Rhea raised her hand, the spider was crushed, a mushed body and tangle of broken legs. She noticed the Fury's dark eyes staring out at her between a gap in her wall of crimson hair.
Do you see where I'm going with this? You are powerful, oh yes, a strong warrior, fit to serve a queen. Probably strong enough to kill a queen. But you won't, will you? Because if you try, I will crush you.
Rhea slammed her fist down again and again, and with each hammer blow the table shook and the Fury flinched. She stopped abruptly, letting silence fall like a scythe. She stood, approached the woman, who she had taken to death's doorstep and back again. Reached down, enjoying the way the Fury trembled in anticipation of the blow she thought would come. But Rhea didn't strike her. Not this time. Instead, she peeled back the hair on one side, tucking it behind the woman's ear. Then she did the same on the other side, until she could see her entire face. A ragged W was carved in her skin, from temple to chin to temple, and for a moment Rhea admired her handiwork. It was a near-perfect match for her own facial scars. At the time her own face was cut, she'd thought it was the end of her life, when, in reality, it had been the beginning. It had opened her eyes to a world beyond beauty, beyond wealth, a world that existed only on power, and those who had it. It had only been a few fortnights ago, but it seemed an eternity since the W on her own face stood for whore, though that wasn't public knowledge. No, the people of Night's End, her loyal and adoring subjects, thought the mark stood for wrath, a symbol of her righteousness and devotion to their deity. The Fury closed her eyes as Rhea ran the fingernail of her thumb along the scab, which was finally beginning to heal. She traced the W from end to end and then back again, relishing the feel of it. When she was finished, she said,
"Whom do you serve?"
The woman's lips moved, but Rhea couldn't make out her words.
"Repeat, louder."
"I serve the queen,"
the woman said through cracked lips.
Be more specific.
I serve the Queen, Rhea Loren, first of her name, Roth's humble servant.
Yes, you do. And you will do great things. You have been forgiven of your sins. Now kiss the ring.
She held out her left hand and the ring that adorned it, its thick gold band studded with an enormous blue diamond, the only one of its kind, at least as far as Rhea knew. It was the Ring of Kings, a family heirloom passed down for generations. She'd plucked it from her dead cousin's fingers herself after she'd killed him. The woman's eyes flashed open, the surprise obvious in her expression. Rhea knew she expected more pain, more torture, not mercy. Which is exactly why she chose now to offer the woman a second chance, because she knew she would take it. The Fury kissed her ring, the one Rhea had once kissed while her cousin Jove, the king at the time, had worn it. She'd killed him a moment later. Rhea knew it was only the beginning. Not only had the bootmaker given her shelter when she was at her weakest, but he had given her a beautiful pair of boots, the finest Rhea had ever seen. Now Jordan Vaughan stood before her throne, looking uncomfortable as he shifted his weight from foot to foot. His storm-grey eyes darted from the Fury to Rhea and back to the Fury.
"Do you know why you are here?"
Rhea asked.
Well, no, not exactly. I was hoping your boots didn't need repairs so soon.
Rhea was surprised when a very real smile creased her face. This grey-eyed old man had showed her kindness when she wasn't certain she deserved it, and she owed him.
No, good sir. The boots remain as perfect as the day you gave them to me.
She lifted her purity dress slightly, to show him that she was wearing them, and he blushed.
Good. That's good.
I sent for you for a far more auspicious purpose. I could use your services.
His eyes widened.
Another pair of boots?
How about 5,000?
His jaw dropped, and he began licking his lips back and forth. Then his face fell.
I'd have to decline, he said.
Why?
I handcraft all of me boots. An order of that size would take years. Maybe my whole life.
I thought you might say that. What if you created the pattern, and I provided a team of expert leather cutters and seamstresses to manufacture the boots? Would that be fair? I would pay you 3 goldens per pair.
3 goldens per...
The thought trailed away from the aging bootmaker, and he shook his head.
I accept. That's more gold than I've ever dreamed of. But why are you doing this?
Rhea stood up, floating down the steps toward him. She touched his cheek briefly with her palm, and she felt him trembling. Fear, excitement, anxiety. It was all running through him, just beneath his skin.
Because you showed me great kindness once, and I need boots for my army. Your boots will help protect the Roth-loving people of our great kingdom.
Thank you, Queen Rhea,
he said.
From the bottom of me heart, thank you.
She watched him go, surprised at how warm she felt all of a sudden. 5. The Northern Kingdom, Gearhead. Anis Gerrick. Anis Gerrick never expected to be a queen.
Frozen hell, I never wanted to be a queen, she thought, sitting by Arch's bedside.
No, she'd planned to live out her time as a princess, until her father, Wulfric Gerrick, the dread king of the north, died of old age, and her brother Archer, as the eldest male heir, took the throne. However, she was quickly learning that the more you expected something, the less likely it was to happen. Her father had been murdered by the brother she'd thought died long ago, the brother who was now known as King's Bane. And then she'd had a name day, leaving her as the queen until Arch turned 18, which was still almost 2 long years away.
Originally, she'd planned to relinquish all rights to the crown to her brother, regardless of his age. But then something had happened. She'd changed, and Arch had been injured in battle. She'd held vigil by his bedside for days, taking her meals there, sleeping on a lumpy cot brought in by the owner of the tavern they were staying in, the Laughing Mammothen, a formidable, broad-faced woman named Netta, who also happened to make the best mammothen stew in all of the Four Kingdoms, at least by Anise's reckoning. Now, as she stared at her brother's handsome, peaceful face, she wondered whether, when he awoke, he would hate her for stealing his throne. She also wondered if today would be the day he finally opened his eyes. The healer said some people came out of such a condition in mere days. Others took longer, sometimes months, requiring liquid meals and water to be dribbled down their throats to sustain them. Anise didn't want to think about the third group of people, the ones who never woke up. There was a knock on the door, but Anise didn't look up. It was probably Lady Zelda, her eccentric aunt, once more requesting a queenly decision on strategy. The truth was, Anise wasn't ready to make a decision. Not with Archer like this. And yet she couldn't delay much longer, for the more her uncle, Lord Griswold, sat upon the Ice Throne and played king, the more the Northerners would assume the crown was his. Anise sighed when there was a second knock. "If you don't have a hot bowl of mammothen stew, go away!" she shouted. The door opened slowly, but not all the way. Just a crack. A white piece of cloth fluttered through the opening. "Don't throw anything," a voice called through. Sir Dietrich. Though he was the best swordsman Anise had ever known, and he had saved both hers and Arch's lives during the battle at Raiders Pass, twice they'd argued in the last 2 days. And, yes, she might have thrown a boot at him, which explained his odd request. "Are you ready to talk about the burn scar on your back?" Anise asked. "We've already talked about that." More white flag waving. Well, white shirt waving. "Shut the door," Anise said. Dietrich had given her a story about his scar, but Anise was certain it was a lie, or at least only a fraction of the truth. "Frozen hell, woman!" the knight said, pushing the door open the rest of the way and dropping the white shirt. He crossed his arms over his face, presumably to protect himself from projectiles. He wasn't wearing his armor, merely a white cloth shirt tied up the front, and sturdy-looking trousers secured with a leather belt. A long sword dangled from a scabbard. "One, don't call me woman. I am your queen. Two, I'm not going to throw anything at you, so you can stop acting like an unflowered maiden. And three, you don't have any mammoth and stew for me. That perturbs me greatly." Sir Dietrich's strong arms dropped away from his head, revealing his scarred but handsome face, and two bright periwinkle eyes that always seemed to contain a hint of mischievousness. Anise launched the boot she was hiding behind her leg. Dietrich's arms came up, but they were too slow and also too high, protecting his face. Unfortunately for him, she had aimed for his crotch, and she had excellent aim on account of all the games of ice wars she'd played as a child. He doubled over, groaning and clutching his midsection. "Now, are you ready to talk?" His only response was a groan. He staggered out, his face green. It looked like his breakfast might make a reappearance. Anise sighed again. What use was being a queen if you couldn't get information out of your subject? She wondered if her boot-throwing antics could be considered torture, and whether she might eventually earn the title Dread Queen of the North, following in her father's footsteps. She laughed at the notion. Arch stirred in his sleep, his head rolling from side to side. Anise froze, watching, hoping. "Please." He continued sleeping, his chest rising and falling with mighty exhalations. "At least he looks peaceful," Anise thought. A shadow fell over her as a massive shape filled the doorway. She couldn't hold back a smile as she looked up, couldn't prevent the loss of breath or the giddy sensation in her chest. But she could hide them. She was a queen, after all, and every queen had to be a master of their emotions. Or at least so Zelda told her, though her aunt was as spontaneous and unpredictable as a winter storm.
To frozen hell with that,
Anise muttered, leaping to her feet and throwing herself at Taryn, who looked confused by both her words and her sudden movement.